This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Coming up, Newark, New Jersey is on its way to get in a police complaint review board. Charges are finally dropped against Black historian Dr. Jahi Issa in Delaware. And we speak to the wife of Reverend Edward Pinckney in prison in Michigan. But first, in January of 2010, an earthquake killed a 250,000 people in Haiti. Later that same year, cholera appeared in Haiti, infecting hundreds of thousands more. International donors promised to raise $10 billion in earthquake relief. However, according to a report by the Center for Economic Policy Research, much of the American aid never left Washington, D.C. Jake Johnston is the principal author of the report, Haiti by the Numbers, 5 years later. We asked Johnston what the actual numbers say about the international relief effort in Haiti.
I think you have to look at exactly how much money was pledged and actually came into the country. So this is enough money to give every Haitian in the country a check for $1,000. Now, you would expect some big results from that. And I think, you know, 5 years later, we can see that while there have been some successes, beneath this sort of veneer was a much more disturbing story. And so, for instance, while many people have left IDP camps, you have almost 300,000 people living on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince in very informal settlement with no government presence. Compared to the scale of the problem, only 9,000 homes have been built by the international response. And we're talking about close to $10 billion that was actually pledged right after the earthquake.
Yes, we saw government and private parties breaking up the camps, but that didn't make homes for the people who were in the camps.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there was a big impetus put on clearing the camps and getting people out of the camps, and much less focus on making sure that those people were returning to something sustainable and weren't either going to houses that hadn't been repaired from the earthquake or simply moving to other places sort of further off the radar and outside of the official IDP list.
Now, you're talking about the accumulated commitment amounting to $1,000 for every Haitian. Of course, every Haitian didn't have their lives destroyed by the earthquake, so we'd be talking about many thousands per affected Haitians. Where did the money go?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, you have to look at sort of how aid is actually delivered to get a better understanding of where the money went. My research is focused mostly on the aspect of USAID and U.S. assistance after the earthquake. And when we look there, we see that most of the money actually went to American firms. This, you know, is no accident. This is actually sort of explicitly part of our foreign aid system. It's supposed to benefit American companies. And so after the earthquake, USAID spent around $1.5 billion. Less than 1% of that actually went to Haitian organizations or Haitian government institutions. And over 55% of that went to firms located inside the Beltway, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. Now, clearly these organizations were working in Haiti, but it gives you a sense of sort of how that money gets distributed onto the ground and how quite a bit of it comes off the top and stays right here in D.C.
Yes, many observers observing that kind of situation believe that that kind of aid giving is intended to discourage actual internal development, but it's part of the way the U.S. does business with its so-called foreign aid all the time.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think also when you look at Haiti, you had a sort of foreign aid system that which clearly existed before the earthquake. And it was actually sort of, you know, in the 80s under the Duvalier dictatorships where they really started bypassing the government altogether. And this was conscious policy, of course, to undermine the government and to not give money to a corrupt government. Now, unfortunately, over the intervening years, that strategy never changed. And so what we've continued to do is sort of erode the public sector through this support to private third-party actors, quite often American companies.
Now, Haiti is sometimes described as the Republic of NGOs.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, there's a perception that you can't work with the Haitian government, you can't work with Haitian companies because they're all corrupt, because they're going to steal the money. You know, I think if you look at it from a different perspective, and certainly this is the perspective of many Haitians I've talked to over the years, is when you see, you know, large NGOs coming to Haiti with expensive offices, nice cars, drivers, etc., that certainly seems like corruption. It's certainly legal in our foreign aid system, but in terms of the actual effectiveness of that money, you know, it's unclear which actually has a larger impact.
What's the relationship between U.S. and other foreign aid, if we could call it aid, and the restructuring that's going on in Haitian society and economy?
Certainly quite a bit of both U.S. and international support. This is one of the sort of prime examples where you can see these differing priorities from what's actually needed on the ground, which is housing, sustainable solutions for those who are actually affected by the earthquake, and that the big sort of flagship international project after the earthquake is about 5-hour drive north in Caracol, and it's an industrial park up there, and that's where, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of earthquake reconstruction funds actually went. The goal initially was something like 65,000 jobs created. Currently, there's about 5,000 jobs. There have been a number of concerns about the labor conditions in those factories. And, you know, in terms of sort of a sustainable development model, it's entirely unclear that this is, you know, how Haiti will actually move forward. And whereas the urgent needs that remain from the earthquake 5 years ago have been overlooked as for these sort of different development models pushed by outside actors.
So we see earthquake money going to develop areas that were not gravely affected by the earthquake, and still 36%, according to your report, 36% of Haitians lack access to drinking water, and cholera is still roiling across the country.
Yeah, exactly. It remains one of the, you know, most important issues that needs to be addressed. And I think, you know, some of the numbers, we have over 700,000 people who've been affected by cholera, over 8,700 deaths. And, you know, this is a disease that was imported by United Nations troops that have been in Haiti for over a decade. This had nothing to do with the earthquake. And it was simply faulty sanitation practices on their part. Now, this has been established by a number of scientific studies. And yet the UN continues to resist acknowledging their responsibility or taking the lead in providing funds to actually address it. And so you have a situation today where many still continue to lack adequate sewage and sanitation, and yet cholera does continue to kill. In fact, just in the last couple of months, we've seen a massive uptick in the number of cases and number of deaths from cholera, even more so than the year before. And so I think you can still see that this is a massive problem. And today, actually, the UN Security Council is arriving in Haiti, and it will remain to be seen if they will address cholera. There was a recent court case that was thrown out because they ruled the UN had absolute immunity. Now, this is clearly a problem, and I think it remains an impediment to actually addressing the situation on the ground.
If the UN has absolute immunity in Haiti, and the UN is a military occupier in Haiti, what is left of sovereignty in Haiti?
I think this comes back to how we sort of deliver aid and the system that it creates. You know, I think one of the big problems with bypassing the government is that you aren't doing things to strengthen the government. You know, Paul Farmer likes to say the easiest way to strengthen the government is to channel money through it. And, you know, in order for them to sort of take over the sovereignty of their own country and to lead it moving forward, it's going to require that from the international community. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that yet.
Some Haitians would say that the best thing the international community can do is leave Haiti alone and stop interfering with them.
Yes, certainly. I think politically, you know, you can see a lot of the problems with the role of the international community in the current political crisis. There has been sort of unwavering support from the United States, certainly, as well as the UN for the current government, despite some clear indications of non-democratic movements. There currently is no sitting parliament and remains a sort of de facto government currently. And yet, the day before parliament's terms expired, as a deal was supposedly being reached, the U.S. Embassy issued a statement saying that no matter what happened, they would support Marta Lee, the current president. And that was sort of interpreted in Haiti as this green light to have the deal fall apart and to move forward with this de facto government.
And what does the Center for Economic and Policy Research propose and suggest in terms of changes in U.S. policy towards Haiti?
Yeah, well, certainly in terms of the actual delivering of aid, I think the first thing we need to do is just have far more transparency in how we actually spend this money. There's sort of a notion that aid is strictly based on the needs on the ground and will be sort of bettering these people's lives. But in fact, you know, it's quite clear that USAID is designed also to support American foreign policy and to aid that. And I think, you know, we need to have a better understanding of that in order to advocate for the types of changes and common sense changes, really, that would ensure that USAID is more effective moving forward.
And how important is political democracy on the ground in Haiti in terms of overcoming the effects of these catastrophes?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's key. And I think, you know, again, this comes back to the current political crisis and sort of the role in the U.S. in creating this. I mean, you have to go back to the election of 2010 that saw Martelly come to power. You know, this was an election soon after the earthquake in very difficult circumstances. Many people were disenfranchised through ID, through being displaced from the earthquake, losing identification cards, et cetera. And what you saw was sort of predictable, you know, massive an election where less than 20% of the electorate actually voted and even fewer had their votes counted. Nevertheless, the U.S. actually came in and reversed the announced first-round results and put Martelly into the second round, sort of paving his way for the presidency. And since that moment, you know, he has been viewed as, you know, sort of supported by this international community very directly. And I think that's emboldened him to not reach a consensus and not reach out to the opposition. And that's manifesting itself today in the current political crisis.
That was Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic Policy Research in Washington. Newark, New Jersey may soon get a citizen complaint review board to keep the police in check in the majority black city. Mayor Roz Baraka last week announced that the board will have subpoena powers to call its own witnesses and could recommend punishment for police officers engaged in brutality and other abuse of citizens. Mayor Baraka unveiled a draft of the review board's mandate, which was drawn up in consultation with the American Civil Liberties Union and community organizations, including the People's Organization for Progress, or POP. POP has been battling police brutality in Newark for 35 years. We asked POP Chairman Larry Hamm if the proposed police review board would have the power to initiate its own investigations.
Well, this is the point of contention. This is why yesterday's draft will not be the final draft. The CCRB can make recommendations. However, the police director can overrule a recommendation by the CCRB, but he can't just overrule it. He has to appear, according to the executive order, he has to appear in person and submit to the board his reasons for overruling a CCRB recommendation. That is really the issue of contention at this point. So the community organizations feel that there must be some kind of appeal process before a final decision is made, that the police director should not be able to just essentially issue a fait accompli, you know, saying, I disagree and this is it. There should be some type of appeals process. Now, there have been several proposals as to how this appeals process would look, but none of them have been selected yet. And that's probably going to be the central issue that's going to be discussed over the next 30 days. One of the things this executive order includes would be a matrix, that is a decision-making paradigm on disciplinary matters. And the police director is supposed to operate within that paradigm. So he can't make a decision to overrule the CCRB that goes against this particular matrix, this particular paradigm on disciplinary measures. So there is this paradigm, and I think only one other police review board has this, and that's one in Washington, D.C. So it's not like the New York Police Review Board, where the commissioner can just out of hand overrule, dismiss a CCRB recommendation and replace it with one of his own. According to this executive order, it can only be done within the disciplinary framework of the matrix that's already established on these disciplinary matters. I think the CCRB should be proactive. The CCRB has to act on cases that are brought to it. So if a citizen feels that their right has been violated, they can bring that case to the CCRB.
Is the development of this board historic in nature? Are there any other cities that you can compare it to?
This board is historic in nature in the city of Newark because the city of Newark has never had a police review board. People have been demanding a police review board for at least half a century, at least since 1966. It was raised as a community demand almost immediately after New York City established its police review board, and I believe that was 1966. So this is something a half a century in coming. So it's historic in Newark. There are other police review boards around the country. Only a minority of them have subpoena power. Hardly any of them have disciplinary power. And one of the reasons they don't have disciplinary power is because the entities established to discipline police are encoded in law. They're in statutes of the state of New Jersey, and they're also in law as it relates to civil service. So there were some institutional obstacles to establishing the kind of review board that people really want. Because people really want a review board that can make discipline stick. And that's why this 30-day period is going to be important, because this will be the last chance to really try to convince the mayor to have some type of measure in there that will reinforce discipline. Because the police behavior is not going to change unless they know there are consequences and penalties and punishment for abusing citizens' rights, using excessive force, and killing people unjustifiably.
Has there been any pushback from the police unions on this, and do you foresee any barriers arising from the New Jersey legislature infringing on the mandate that you think the board should have?
Well, the unions, they were pushing back before even this public announcement. They were also being consulted. Community groups weren't the only groups that were being consulted. I guess the mayor consulted every entity that he thought was a stakeholder in this process, and that included the unions. And yes, they had objections then. They had objections. The president of the FOP made his objections known. And I imagine there's going to be a fight around this. There's probably going to be a fight around it, even if the mayor issues a final version of his executive order that does not include discipline. I would bet my money right now that the unions are going to continue to fight it. They're going to go to the state legislators, and I'm sure that they're going to go to Governor Christie. And I would bet money that Governor Christie will weigh in on this in his role both as governor and in his role as a person seeking the Republican nomination for president of the United States. I can't see them resisting the temptation to weigh in on the side of the police in order to get more votes.
And what should folks in the community be doing in the next 30 days to try to shape this new police review board?
For the next 30 days, people in Newark, people elsewhere who are concerned about this issue should be putting in writing their concerns and emailing them directly to the office of the mayor. They should be calling for the strongest possible review board, one that either has disciplinary powers or by law these powers be devolved to the review board. That review board should then be included in the disciplinary process. If it can't actually make the final decision, it should have some input into the disciplinary process. Because in the final analysis, we want a review board that people can say is effective. We don't want a review board that people look at like they're looking at many of these review boards in many cities, including New York City, as being ineffective. We don't want to establish that. And I'm going to tell folks right now, they're going to have to send as many letters, email, texts, tweets, Instagram messages, send as many as possible to let the office of the mayor know that we want the strongest possible review board. I also want to say this about the mayor. I think he is doing a good job. I think the executive order that he has issued for the establishment of the review board is certainly a step in the right direction. I believe that this mayor is bringing us closer to the realization of a police review board in the city of Newark, closer than we have ever been before. And even with what he has issued now, I think it's a bold and daring move as far as mayors go, because no other mayor in any of the other 500 municipalities in the state of New Jersey is issuing a similar executive order. So I commend the mayor for the action he's taken and the way he's done it. He's genuinely reached out in the most general way, get community input. And I'm telling you, even this version of the review board that's in the executive order draft, much of what is in that version is a result of the input that community organizations have had in this process. So I commend the mayor for what he's done thus far. However, I cannot escape thinking about all the victims of police brutality in the city of Newark and elsewhere. I can't escape the impact that their deaths have had on us, on many of us. And I know that we are going to need the most effective review board possible in order to change police behavior. The police as an institution are one of the most intractable. That's why police brutality continues to occur. And I would dare say that even after the establishment of this review board, police brutality will continue to occur. However, if we have a review board that is effective, I believe it will have an ameliorating impact on this problem. And I have to say this, that since the Justice Department issued its report this summer and called for placing the Newark Police Department under a consent decree and federal monitor, to my knowledge, there haven't been any police killings in Newark in the last 6 months. So this discussion and this process going back to this summer when the Justice Department issued its report, just the discussion, I feel, has had an impact on the police. So if we have an effective review board, it won't eliminate the problem, but I think it may have an impact in terms of bringing down the number of deaths caused by police shootings.
So eyeballs on police do affect their behavior.
Absolutely. I would dare say even the election of Ross Baraka, who's known to be an anti-police brutality activist, I was there almost 20 years ago when he led a march, when he was the activist Ross Baraka, when he was the head of a group called Black Near Force, and they led a march out of the South Ward. They marched over 500 people down on City Hall, and we had a black man, and his name was Sharp James. And they marched down on City Hall in the aftermath of the shooting and killing of Strawberry Daniels, a young black woman that a police officer had shot in the head. And there was almost a review board created then, because the community outcry was so great that Sharp James, within a matter of days, had called a big meeting. And I know because I was there, called a big meeting of representatives of community groups to talk about the establishment of a police review board in Newark, and concrete steps were being taken. And then, you know, a couple of months after, the process got derailed and it never got back on track again.
So you don't want it to slip out of your hands again?
No, we don't want it to slip out again. Not when we have such a good grip. We have a grip now. We got to drag this thing in the right direction, you know. And I'm telling you, this has been a real lesson for me in terms of seeing the dynamic of how institutions and political leaders act when presented with a really serious proposal for change. There's really a lot of contention. There's been a lot of push and pull around this police review board. And I don't want to go too deeply into it yet, but I think it's going to all come out publicly anyway before this is all over.
That is, who was really for putting brakes on the police and who not?
You took the words right out of my mouth. But I just want to reiterate again, I think we're in for a big fight. Even with the review board as it would currently be established by this version of the executive order, there's going to be a big fight on this, especially with the FOP weighing in publicly on this already. I know they're going to go to the legislature. I speculate that they're going to challenge the mayor on the issue of subpoena power. The police are going to get some of these legislators that they have in their hip pocket, and they're going to question, can the mayor really give subpoena power to this review board? So it's going to be a fight. I would be surprised if this thing gets established without a really serious fight, political struggle. If Newark is successful in establishing this review board, other cities are going to want to establish a review board of this type.
Because it's not just a model for the community, it's also a model for the police that they would want to resist.
That's right. The police see themselves, especially the leadership, and perhaps even into the rank and file, they see themselves as special and as above the law and as above reproach. They really do. That's what all this Sturm und Drang is about since the shooting of those police. So it really came out in the aftermath of the unfortunate murder of those two police officers in New York City. The comments that Pat Lynch, the head of the police union there in New York City, the comments that he's made, they really feel themselves above reproach. They don't think citizens have the right to criticize them or to judge them. And this is a real problem because this is the ideology that motivates them.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress. Charges have been dropped against Dr. Jahi Issa, who was fired from Delaware State University 3 years ago. Dr. Issa had been arrested at a student demonstration against the rapid whitening of the historically black school. A trial last year resulted in a hung jury on the sole misdemeanor charge of resisting arrest, but the state of Delaware insisted on trying him again. This month, a judge threw the charges out.
The judge decided that he was going to dismiss the case with prejudice after the Attorney General's office said that they were ready to prosecute me again. This judge said he didn't see any necessity in doing this again. Over.
With prejudice, of course, means that the state can't bring those charges again, but they certainly did want to continue putting you through this ordeal.
Yes, and this is interesting because now we have a new attorney general. The first charges for the first year and a half was under Attorney General Bo Biden, who's no longer Attorney General. He has plans to run for governor in 2016. But this second Attorney General, his name is Matt Dean, when he first came into office 2 weeks ago, he announced that he was going to start a civil rights office, an office on civil rights, which will deal with people's whose rights have been violated by the state. And when we submitted this document to his office, people had sent letters to him saying that they should look into my case for possible civil rights violations. He looked it over and said, we're going to prosecute Dr. Issa anyway. And so it's pretty much the same old issues, just a different face, but this particular judge felt no need to continue on the waste of taxpayers' money on one misdemeanor, which they couldn't prove, which was on video. And so I'm happy for that.
Well, this whole saga began when you were, in fact, as I understand it, a bystander, an observer to a student demonstration at Delaware State.
Yeah, I just witnessed the Delaware State University administration, including its chief of police and other minor administrators, providing students constitutional rights to protest, peacefully assemble, and grieve government. And since I witnessed these abuses, I spoke out against it. I simply said that the students had a right to constitutionally grieve their issues, to petition government. They were all going to a board of trustee meeting, and I saw no need for the police to stop them in that process. And this is exactly what my attorney, Mr. Sam Guy, also stated in his press release on his Facebook page. He said that the president of Delaware State, Harry Lee Williams, who's black, and the chief of police, Harry Downs, who's black, should be ashamed of themselves because they arrested me and assaulted me in front of the Martin Luther King Student Center, where students gathered, and which was right across the street from Megger Ever Hall. And my attorney, he said that in his press release that the president and the chief of police need to go see Selma, the movie, because obviously they don't understand nor respect history. And if this is the new crop of HBCU leadership that is now taking over the administration and overseeing the education of black students, then we're seriously in trouble.
Well, you had not made friends with this black administration. You maintained, as did many of those students, that Delaware State was rapidly becoming not an HBCU, at least only in name an HBCU, that it was being turned white.
Yes, it's pretty much a white university. Cultural hegemony dominates that school and many other schools. Most of the faculty is non-African American, meaning indigenous to this country, unlike the faculty that I had at HBCUs like Howard University and Southern University. The student body is decreasingly African American, and so no, it's not an HBCU in the traditional sense, and I say it's a big scam going on all over the country where states are purposely deculturalizing HBCUs, while at the same time they're doing this, they are fraudulently accepting money that is guaranteed by the federal government to black people and giving it away to non-black people. And this is a law. These are laws that are on the books. And because I wrote about it and spoke out about it, and the students felt a need to talk about it to the administration, Harry Williams and his staff made a unilateral decision to deny me my constitutional rights, in which the state of Delaware Attorney General's office decided that they were going to continue this prosecution persecution without any avail.
Quite clearly, HBCUs are in crisis on many levels, but it appears that rather than resisting the forces that would erase HBCUs, some of these black administrations are, in fact, going along with the flow.
Yeah, they're going along with the flow because over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen a rapid decrease of African-American educators at these HBCUs who are concerned with the plight of African-Americans. And so these are more opportunists who are at these schools, and they're willing to do anything to get a couple of $100,000 a year. And so if their masters tell them to destroy the education by watering down the African-American faculty and bring in a lot of reactionary people who really don't understand African-American culture and can care less about black people who don't feel that black lives matter, then many of these HBCU presidents, not all of them, but many of them, and growingly more every day, are deciding that, hey, it's a paycheck for me, it's a large payoff, and all I have to do is make sure that African-Americans disappear from these universities, and I'll do that. It's up to the alumni and concerned citizens to fight this off, because this is very serious. We're witnessing the end of not just HBCUs, but African Americans as we know it.
President Obama wants to guarantee 2 years of community colleges to everyone who wants to attend, but how have his policies affected HBCUs over these past 6 years?
The White House has decided that HBCUs are, for the most part, a threat to United States security. They have to be a threat. Because why would President Obama gradually, over the last 6 years, cut federal aid to HBCUs? And he, just recently, in 2013, the White House made sure that more than 30,000 African Americans who attended HBCUs would not be able to get the federal aid that they needed to stay in these schools. So we had, for almost 2 years, 30,000 students unable to go to school. He didn't come out and apologize for that. He did nothing. And these African Americans who I really don't understand, who sit on White House boards, who claim that they love this black president, while at the same time, this president is cutting off their heads and their children's future.
Some fear that President Obama's focus on community colleges will, in effect and in practice, render HBCUs redundant.
Yes, it's going to destroy HBCUs. Unless African Americans get out in droves and make HBCUs a priority, they have to do this. Education is not just about getting a job. It's about survival. These HBCUs are important to black people because they have helped black people to survive a racist, white supremacist system for the last 150 years. Without them, we would have had no Thurgood Marshalls. Without them, we would not have had the likelihoods of people like Chancellor Williams teaching us. Without them, we would have no Du Bois or Ida B. Wells. So this has to be a priority of black people. They have to decide whether or not they want to survive in this country or whether or not they want to continually go down this dismal road that we've been on for the last 6 years. It's up to them. If black people make the decision that that's what they want to do, that is, they want these HBCUs to disappear, then so will black people disappear.
Well, now that you're free and clear of these charges, no thanks to the state of Delaware, where are you taking your career and your struggle?
Well, 3 years without a job and 3 years of thousands and thousands of dollars spent on attorney fees has basically exhausted me. But, you know, I still have the spirit of God in me, and there's nothing that these people can do to give me back the relationship that I had with these students that I've missed over the last 3 years. There's nothing that they could do to give me back the relationship that I lost with my family. But God is good anyway. I'm still here. I'm still breathing. And I will continue to talk about this issue and the importance of African-American education until I die. And so this is a mission like the black abolitions of past. I'm in that tradition, and I will continue to focus on those issues.
And that administration at Delaware State, that shanghaied you off, are they still intact?
Well, I hope within the next couple of weeks they won't be. If anything, if they don't go to jail, Harry Williams, Harry L. Williams, and Chief Downs, and many of those others who participated in denying me my constitutional rights and who lies against me and the students, they deserve, if anything, not to be fired, to go to jail. You know, my auntie and my mother would always tell me, be careful of what you want and wish for other people because you may get it.
Dr. Jahi Issa in Dover, Delaware. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has been behind bars for 34 years, most of them on Pennsylvania's death row. In a previous life, Abu-Jamal had been a Black Panther and a radio journalist and a husband and father. But Mumia's been thinking about the trials and tribulations of another political activist from an earlier generation. He files this report for Prison Radio.
His name is known to millions, but few know of his trials and tribulations, how the nation's federal policing agency, the FBI, hounded him and tormented him until his dying day. He is lauded today, and a majestic statue stands in the Capitol, less than a mile from a building named for his nemesis, J. Edgar Hoover, who loathed him and taped his hotel rooms, his phones, and his friends. Hoover tried every day to destroy him. I speak, of course, of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In his last year, after his Riverside speech in New York, he faced the betrayal of those he thought were his friends and allies and the furious denunciation of the media. Why? Because at Riverside, he spoke against U.S. carnage in Vietnam, U.S. greed, and U.S. racism. He criticized capitalism, and everything changed. Everything. He was called irrelevant, out of touch, out of his depths, unaware of reality, and much, much more. The very media that once portrayed him in heroic lights turned the lights off, closed its pages, and covered their microphones. This isolation served to make him vulnerable to the forces that sought his destruction. That's who Martin Luther King was in the twilight of his life, hounded, harassed, and harried by his government. Let us not forget.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal. Prison Radio has reporters in prisons across the United States. Carrie Shekabuna Marshall has been incarcerated in Pennsylvania for the past 25 years on a life sentence for a crime committed when he was a juvenile. Marshall is also correspondent and co-founder of The Movement magazine. He says the United States Constitution, which is celebrated as one of the world's premier documents of human freedom, actually sanctions the practice of slavery.
For the past 150 years, the American government has perpetrated a fraud on its citizens that it abolished slavery of Africans in America by passing of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. While the 13th Amendment abolished the chattel labor form of slavery, it simultaneously legalized slavery as a punishment for a criminal offense conviction. The 13th Amendment states, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, or any place subject to their jurisdiction. The 13th Amendment Slavery Exception Clause simply wrote in a new legal form of slavery, penal slavery, that is, the prison slave labor system. The new prison slavery form had freed black people in mind from the beginning, was established soon after the Civil War and after the passing of the 13th Amendment, with southern states adopting black codes, laws specifically designed to re-enslave black people for violating so-called crimes of vagrancy, loitering, debt, being unemployed, changing jobs without permission of previous employer, and more. Once re-enslaved in prison and forced into the prison's work crews or chain gangs, black prisoner slaves were leased out to private corporations to provide free labor and what was called the convict leasing system. After the Civil War, through the convict leasing slave system, re-enslaved African people were forced to provide free labor, subjected to the bullwhip, had no rights as a citizen, and most were never released from prison ever again. The slavery exception clause of the 13th Amendment and black codes allow former white southern slave ruling class to re-enslave freed African people through the criminal injustice system by a process of criminalization and mass incarceration of black people. That persists in America to this day. In the modern era of the 21st century in America, we now live in a society where forced slave labor has been legalized through the criminal injustice system, where poor black, Latino, and white people are forced to provide free labor to private corporations and stripped of all civil rights. America refuses to accept that slavery by any other name is still slavery.
That was Carrie Shekabuna Marshall reporting from the Pennsylvania State Prison at Rockview. Last month, Benton Harbor, Michigan activist Reverend Edward Pinckney was sentenced to 2.5 to 10 years in prison on election petition tampering charges. The 66-year-old activist has led a tireless campaign against the gentrification and political domination of the mostly black town by the giant Whirlpool Corporation, which is headquartered in Benton Harbor. Pinckney was briefly jailed in 2008 for his campaign against Whirlpool. His conviction in December involved a campaign to recall the town's newly elected mayor, who is an ally of Whirlpool. We spoke with Reverend Pinckney's wife and partner in struggle, Dorothy.
Yes, I do miss him very much. can't wait for him to get home and take back over his responsibilities. he's doing very well. They have not broken his spirit. So the best way I can describe how he's doing is just by saying he's still Reverend Pinckney.
Well, this is not the first time that the long arm of the law has snatched him away.
That's true. Yeah, he was away in 2008 for almost a year.
Are the powers that be gloating, happy that they have him back in their clutches again?
Very much so. I mean, it's like, to me, I feel like they were celebrating even before his sentence, because they felt that they had already won the victory by sending him away. So it was all like, to me, it was all prearranged. They already knew what was going to happen before it happened. So sure, they were happy.
And Whirlpool must be happiest of all.
Of course, because Whirlpool is the lead ringer in this situation. I mean, Whirlpool produced the money. So all power to be has to answer to Whirlpool.
In addition to taking your husband physically away from your house and home, this trial and the aftermath has caused lots of personal hardship.
Yes, you know, and it's really strange, Glenn, that before my husband was sentenced on December the 15th, the judge told him, I'm going to make an example out of you. So the mayor-to-be, Hightower, told the judge that my husband had caused him financial hardship. And I'm going, this is stupid. When you, the mayor, so-called mayor, initiated this whole thing that opened up the door for them to come against my husband, and you can't see that you're causing us financial distress?
So here is the mayor complaining about his financial distress when your breadwinner and husband has been taken away, and I'm sure it's inflicted dire consequences on your finances.
Yes, we're not Fred Upton, who's the heir of Whirlpool. We don't have that kind of money. You know, we're just trying to survive like everyone else. But when you come into our home and you take away finances that we don't have, that's a hardship. But, you know, with the help of God, I mean, he provides for us to get through day by day.
And what about Banco, the organization that your husband founded?
Banco is active. Active as far as letting people know exactly what's going on. Our situation is being updated daily on the Banco website. And the only thing is that we're asking whosoever will to send donations to Banco, but it's for my husband's legal defense. They can send donations by mail to Banco, B-A-N-C-O, at 1940 Union, U-N-I-O-N Avenue, in Benton Harbor, Michigan, 49022.
You can also Google the Banco website to make a PayPal contribution. Just enter Reverend Pinckney and B-A-N-C-O, and the site will pop right up. Larry Pinckney is no relation to Edward Pinckney, but he's handling the Reverend's media campaign and political defense. Larry Pinckney is a veteran activist, formerly with the Black Panther Party and the Republic of New Africa. We ask him how Reverend Pinckney is holding up.
They're trying to break his will because, you know, he's not getting his mail. They've moved him way up to Marquette, Michigan. But the brother, he's a warrior. He's a fighter. He's standing tall.
Every political prisoner needs a political defense. What kind of defense are you guys putting together for Reverend Pinckney?
Well, what we are working on is a very, very aggressive defense. Now, I say we now, I'm talking in terms of these activists that are involved. We have a small committee that we call the Central Coordinating Committee. And our intention and our job is to urge the attorneys to go on the offense and stop being defensive. For example, on December 15th, when Reverend Edward Pinckney, that's December 15th, 2014, when Reverend Pinckney was sentenced to prison, procedurally, the court had not even heard the motions that were before the court. I mean, this is unheard of. A number of motions, one dealing directly with the fact that at least one of the jurors was a close associate of the very people who have prosecuted Reverend Edward Pinckney. So we as political activists are trying to get the attorneys to vigorously do their job. And we've just learned as of this morning that there's to be a hearing on the 24th of February, next month, on the very motions that were timely filed before Reverend Pinckney was sentenced. So, I mean, this is what we're up against. But we are turning on steam all over the place. When I say turning on steam, I mean that many, many, many people, both nationally and internationally now, are directly involved in politicizing folks as to what was going on in Benton Harbor in terms of Whirlpool Corporation, in terms of austerity, and specifically in terms of Reverend Edward Pinckney being targeted, which he was undoubtedly targeted.
Now, Reverend Pinckney wasn't trying to storm the barricades or take over a factory. He was simply trying to organize folks in an election campaign. What does this say about the state of America and the state of Michigan?
To be blunt, I think it says there's no such thing as democracy in its true sense in Michigan or, quite frankly, throughout the United States. I mean, Reverend Pinckney was standing up to the so-called emergency managers that they've used both in Detroit and in Benton Harbor and now coming to us in cities throughout the United States. And, of course, these so-called emergency managers were not elected, and nor are they answerable to the people. So I think what we have is veiled fascism, 21st century fascism. And Reverend Pinckney, you're so correct when you said that Reverend Pinckney, he wasn't storming the Bastille. He was not storming the factories. He was simply trying to awaken, as a sister put it to me the other day, simply trying to awaken the slaves. And it was working.
That was Larry Pinckney, a spokesman for Reverend Edward Pinckney. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon says that what the French cartoon magazine Charlie Hebdo does and what TV's Bill Maher does is not humor or political satire. It's chauvinism of the worst kind.
When you want to understand how the big wide world works, you don't look back at yourself and try to make it rhyme with what you think you already know. That means you do not ask smug, Eurocentric, self-congratulatory Bill Maher type questions like, why are they so touchy? How come those backward Muslims can't separate their religion from politics? If you actually want to understand why some fraction of Muslims saw gratuitous insult instead of satire when the French magazine Charlie Hebdo depicted the Prophet Muhammad doing things you would not want your own small children to see, or depicting pregnant Muslims as Boko Haram sex slaves howling for their welfare checks, all you've got to do is look at two bits of history. Philosopher Karen Armstrong, in her latest book, Religion and Political Violence, goes a long way to break it down. The first bit of history, Armstrong explains, is that the notion of religion as a set of practices and beliefs about the deity, which you can perform on Sundays, separate from how you put together political and economic life, is an exclusively Western concept that nobody on earth before 17th and 18th century Europeans would recognize at all. The Sanskrit, Jewish, Arabic, and other old world terms for religion all mean something that recognizes no separation between politics, economics, and morality and moral life. It took more than a century of warfare in the 16 and 1700s at a cost of hundreds of thousands of European lives in order to establish that kind of religion in Europe which could be separated from politics and economics. That way, European elites could have slavery and capitalism. European rulers could exterminate tens of millions in history's greatest genocide colonizing the New World and still call themselves Christians. Non-European Muslims are being allowed only a generation or two, and fortunately a lot less bloodshed, to make that kind of transition, which brings us to Armstrong's second bit of relevant history. She reminds us that the 20th century's so-called modernizers in the Muslim world mostly did not do it with friendly and democratic persuasion. Under the approving eyes of the West, they did it forcibly, with secret police, torture, discriminatory laws, kangaroo courts, and especially in Iran, sponsored by Britain and the U.S., with bullets fired into crowds of often nonviolent protesters. In addition to needed reforms, like curtailing Sharia law, Turkey's Kemal Atatürk, the Pahlavis in Iran, and Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser each locked up sometimes thousands of religious opponents and purged them from the civil service and political life. This ain't exactly how you train people to engage in a friendly, respectful, and civil discussion of religious and political differences. It is how you make lasting enemies, enemies ready and alert for the next slight or insult. But this is the real and relevant history Americans have trained themselves not to know. Add to this the wave of armed U.S. and European interventions in Muslim lands, our puppet governments, our occupations, our torture campaigns and drone strikes, and factor in that even while cruise missile liberals like Bill Maher and U.S. presidents say we just don't do religious war, U.S. military personnel, at the tip of the spear, as they say, call their enemies Hajis, and police departments in the U.S. and Europe surveil Muslim communities wholesale and incarcerate Muslims disproportionately. In this context, unlike jokes exposing the foibles of the powerful, which are real satire, Charlie Hebdo, which is now subsidized by the French government, is engaged in something much like war propaganda. And Bill Maher is just another cruise missile liberal, a bully.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.